This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who loves a good book. Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my next guest, Robert K. Tannenbaum, a New York Times bestselling author whose latest book, Infamy, is very, very timely. Hi.
How are you?
Hi. Should I call you Robert or Bob?
Bob is good, Patsy.
Okay, Bob. Well, it's so great to talk to you. This, of course, is it's the 28th in your series of Butch Karp and Marlene Ciampi series.
Yes.
And there's so much, you know, this, of course, is a courtroom drama, but it's also an international thriller. And you bring the courtroom drama to life, because that's how you lived your life so much of your life.
That's, I know. Right. When I graduated from law school, I went out to the University of California. I'm from New York, of course, and I grew up in Brooklyn. And
yeah, I think we could guess that from your accent.
That's why I said it, you know. Interesting. When I went to college, I went to a basketball scholarship to play at Berkeley at Cal, and For the first time, I was told I had an accent. I thought the only people in America who had accents were people living below the Mason-Dixon line, but I found out otherwise. Mm-hmm. So I guess when you're born in Brooklyn, you get inoculated with a speech pattern and stays with you in perpetuity. But I went to work when I graduated from law school. I spent 7 years at Cal College and law school, and went back to New York, came home, and worked for Frank Hogan, district attorney, who was a legend. He was greater in life even than his great legend. And I had two mentors in the DA's office, John Keenan, who's a federal district court judge now in the Southern District of Manhattan. He was my bureau chief in the Homicide Bureau, and then Mel Glass was my bureau chief in the criminal court. So I had,
You have the background.
And you're on the shoulders of giants, believe me, and any success I had is attributable to Mel Glass, John Keenan, and District Attorney Frank Hogan. And
well, you're pretty much of a legend yourself, because you never lost a felony case when you were the assistant New York County DA.
Yes, I know. And that's because I had great detectives. I was well-trained, and we worked harder than the defense did in every case we had. But it was a great, great experience on how justice should be administered. And there's just no Republican or Democrat way to gather evidence, and there's certainly no liberal or conservative way to evaluate it. And it was a Ministry of Justice. It was totally apolitical. It was a case-by-case analysis, qualitative analysis of what ought to happen in the case. So, and then there were cases marked no lesser plea, where no matter what the situation was, the defendant would either plead to the indictment and let the court sentence him, or we had to trial. So I tried a couple of hundred cases in the office, and it was a tremendous experience. I'd still be there if Frank Hogan were still alive. We would be still living in Manhattan, so there you have it.
Well, you know, New York is so much in everybody's mind at this time, and everybody's thinking about the justice system. And I know that you've always been such a proponent of, you know, the obligation and the to the dignity of the system.
Absolutely, and I think that the most important contribution people in public office can make, in my judgment, is to enhance the dignity of the office when they have it. That certainly happened when Frank Hogan was district attorney and John Keenan and Mel Glass were in that office running it. I ultimately ran the criminal courts and ran the Homicide Bureau, but they set the tone and the standard of it. And when you deal, the very first case, the reason I got into writing books was that the very first case I wrote about was the assassination of two New York City police officers, Waverly Jones and Joseph P. Agentini, who were assassinated. There was no interfacing with the killers. They were self-proclaimed members of the Black Liberation Army. And they were engaging in the kind of conduct that we see today, regrettably, where every police stop potentially could be a deadly ambush. And The only convictions that occurred with these members of the Black Liberation Army were in Manhattan in that case. So I wanted to write about it because I wanted people to understand, and of course the book was Badge of the Assassin, and I wanted people to understand really what's involved from the point of view, from my point of view, a maverick iconoclast within the system, on how you go about gathering evidence and presenting it, given the nature, the political nature of what's going on in the country right now. And then and now is pretty much the same.
It's hard to believe. I think we thought there for at least a few years that all of this was behind us, and it's hard to wake up now every morning to the same thing.
Yeah, we have assassination of police officers, and then we have some questionable issues with respect to the shooting of individuals. So the real problem is that we're not dealing with these cases within the structure of our system in a fair and impartial way. One of the reasons is too many of the politicians, particularly those who seek higher office after they're going to be district attorney, are political. And so they move with the winds of politics, which is exactly what you should never do in the justice system. There is just no the politicization of the justice system
is dangerous.
One of the most damning issues that we face today. We saw in the Duke case, for example, the Duke lacrosse case was a classic example of it, wherein a bunch of college kids on the lacrosse team were charged with rape, and the politics of it fit perfectly for radicalization. And the kids were convicted in the court of public opinion, but it turned out there was no evidence, and the evidence that was suggested was false. So if you had an office like Frank Hogan had in Manhattan, and he was DA before I was born, then you would have had a very careful qualitative analysis of the case, no press conferences. And I think of the Baltimore case, for example, where you have the prosecutor going on having press conferences, talking as if she was some kind of radical politician looking to destroy the system instead of evaluating the case. And, of course, the cases wound up in acquittals. So that's the damning part of what's happening today. And we need to have people in law enforcement who are going to be totally apolitical. And head of the FBI, Mr. Comey, didn't help the situation one whit, did he?
No.
Well, so that's part of and parcel of the two-tiered system of justice. It's not two-tiered minority v. the wealthy. It's those who are connected politically who are walking away in large measure having committed serious acts of wrongdoing.
Well, of course, in your new book, In Infamy, you touch on all of what we've just been talking about, and on this the greater aspect of what's all behind it. That's why your book is so timely. You know, you talk right from the first chapter. We know that we are in something that is current, something that is happening today.
And very much so, because what's going on is there are certain people in the so-called elite, anointed, self-anointed group of individuals in our system that rationalize illegality as justified because they're working for the, quote, greater good, close quote, and therefore they could do what they want with impunity. And that kind of attitude is completely destructive of the entire process of constitutional law. And in our case, we, of course, have a potential whistleblower who gets killed in Manhattan, and the powers that be going right up through the highest ranking members of our elected government are involved in do whatever you have to do, because lust for power will permit us to stay in government as long as we can, because we are the anointed, and the rest of the population, basically, as they see it, is the benighted. We are the dopes and the dupes. And they threaten, they do anything they can in order to turn the screws on those who seek justice. But because we have Roger Butch Karp and Marlene Champion in Manhattan, we see whether or not they're going to persevere through this. And ultimately, in a courtroom in Supreme Court New York County, we resolve some of these issues with a very garish confrontation between the elitists, those who think that they are beyond the law, way beyond, and the law as it is crystallized and focused upon by District Attorney Roger Butch Karp.
Well, you know, the character, Robert Butch Karp, is brilliant. I think you really came out with a great character that has driven through all of these 28 books, because, again, it's somebody, I'm sure, not unlike yourself, who wants to see justice done and wants to see the system work.
Absolutely. That was exactly what my training was. It's the reason why I actually went to law school, was to work in District Attorney Hogan's office, never realizing that he might say, no, I'm not going to hire you. Then what am I going to do? But the dream came true. It was sort of meant to be, as Mel Glass always said. And it happened, and the experience was even far exceeded even my wildest dream of how honorable it was just to deal with people in the office who were senior people like Judge John Keenan and Judge Mel Glass, as well as many of the judges at the time who were sitting on the bench. But there was a respect for District Attorney Hogan that they understood that justice would be done, and there would be no rationalizing or justifying for greater goods. That did not happen. I can give an example. One of the examples would be the Zuccotti Park, the whole Wall Street takeover. That was, notwithstanding the fact that Zuccotti Park was a private park, crimes were being committed there. And the district attorney in New York County, this was just a few years ago, and did absolutely nothing because they politicized all this. And we wind up with chaos, and that's the real problem that we're facing. The other major problem is people were losing faith in law enforcement if law enforcement is not going to be aggressive and be able to explain in court, not with press conferences. Good DAs should not have press conferences. They should be talking in court. And if that's done, we'll see a major turnaround.
Well, as you said, most DAs today all imagine themselves someday running for president, and so they're laying the groundwork.
That's exactly right. What happens is they see themselves as DA, then become attorney general, and then of the state, and then governor, and then president, and emperor. Who knows? But they want to be able to say that they were DA, and they were tough on crime kind of thing. But they're far from tough on crime. What they're tough on is destroying the very fabric of credibility in our system. And that's what needs to be restored. And that's why I'm so disappointed with Mr. Comey and with those who just turn the other cheek and say, we're dealing here with the greater good concept, which is anathema to our entire system. We have to deal with each of these cases on the merits. And if there is no case, we say it. And if we have evidence beyond a reasonable doubt, we move that case to trial. And that's the way the system should work.
But too often, I think they love this plea bargaining thing, and then we never find out the truth behind things because they bargain things down, and all of the dirty business gets swept under the rug.
That's exactly right. And that's also one of the issues in infamy is that where you have serious, very serious cases, you mark those cases no less a plea. And that's why I say the defendant then has to plead guilty to the indictment, the top count, or you go to trial. And that's exactly what happens in infamy. They go to trial because Roger Butch Karp, is district attorney of New York County, is not going to take any kind of plea bargain. But that's all part of what I've been writing about, the values that we care most about. And that's who we are as a people. And we care very much. I believe the American people are moral. We try to institutionalize virtue, and we recognize that evil exists, and it must be confronted and destroyed. And evil has many different iterations, as you well know. And it's not just ISIS on the battlefield, which has to be destroyed, but it's the kinds of people who are destroying the system from within, and that will do anything to obtain power because they lust for it. And they engage in corrupt acts, and those corrupt acts have to be brought to justice before the people. And the best way and the only way to do it in our system is in a court of law. And that's why I do the novels, and that's why I'm very, very excited about Infamy, which was just published on the 20th of this month.
Yep. 2 days ago.
Well, yeah, and I'm excited to be with you, Patrick.
Well,
give me a chance to talk about it.
Because I, you know, as I said from the first chapter, it is so timely. It is about ISIS, and it is about, you know, because, of course, we know that it's going to be a courtroom drama simply because we know, you know, that this is going to be a courtroom drama when you're writing it. But we, by opening up with that ISIS right at the beginning, and it just, wow, right away you say, wow, this guy is right on time, you know, just when we need a story to understand what's a little bit about what's going on. Something's strange is going on in this world.
There's no question that we need to answer the question how it is that this country destroyed the Japanese Imperial Army that had destroyed it, that had destroyed the Far East, and how we defeated the Imperial Japanese Army, and at the same time dealt with the Wehrmacht, the Nazis in Europe, and we don't deal effectively right now with American power and young American kids who are sensational, who are in the military, same kids, I could tell you, who were at Yorktown, who were at Normandy and in the Pacific theaters, and why they aren't destroyed forthwith on the battlefield, their infrastructure, the actual individuals who are wreaking mayhem on other individuals. You know, the world looks to America as the moral, as the moral nation of the world, where hopefully our strength is to keep peace. It's not for aggrandizement, not for advanced territories. And when we pull back from that position, we see the chaos that results. So there are certain reasons for all this, and some of those reasons I discuss very graphically in Infamy.
Very graphically, and the whole thing, it's so heartbreaking that our boys are being sent out into these areas without a clear understanding of what can be done, without real support behind them. And you touch on all of that in Infamy. It's a great read.
Well, I really appreciate that. I'll give you an example of exactly what you were talking about. There's a young man who is in our family who was in he fought in the surge in 07 and 08. And then he had tour duty in Afghanistan. He had two beautiful young daughters at home and an incredible wife. That kind of sacrifice is enormous, as you can imagine. And yet the rules of engagement that these politicians, these corrupt people, heartless in my judgment, place upon our kids who are fighting against these savage characters, where they're cutting people's heads off, they're maiming, they're doing the most barbaric acts that regrettably humans can inflict upon others. And the rules of engagement are absolutely so wrong. Well, they have JAG officers questioning the acts of those who are in combat to see if they can justify why they shot the enemy. In other words, fire is taken from a building, and they fire back, but they didn't see necessarily the individual terrorist who was firing. And that's a violation of the rules of engagement. And the young man I'm talking about, as a sergeant, as an NCO, the non-commissioned officer who leads his platoon and squads in battle, every time he felt an obligation, every time that there was an attack, he charged towards the fire. Didn't move away from it, but charged towards it so he can take it out and led his men. And he didn't want in leadership to pass that on to someone else. And he did it himself. And then he was questioned by psychologists they brought in as to why he was so aggressive.
Oh, geez.
This is what is happening. It's heartbreaking. It's the same issues about our VAs, the VA hospitals, and the rest of it. And you have politicians dealing with all this kind of stuff, giving double talk. It's very simple. Every person who's ever been a veteran and should have a pass. How much thought does this really take? Go to any hospital. Go to any doctor and get taken care of forthwith. Not within 40 miles of where you live if you can't get in and so on and so forth. But the mistreatment that we give to our vets and the mistreatment that, because of the rules of engagement, that our soldiers are enduring. As a matter of fact, families of our soldiers had to purchase some of the equipment, particularly for our Humvees, that would be laced with steel, so that when the Iranians placed these IEDs, these improvised explosive devices, on the road, that these kids were hitting and being maimed for life. Imagine having your son come home, no leg, no arm, and so on and so forth, because the government didn't provide the necessary equipment. These are the kinds of things that we all have to wake up to and get involved in and deal with effectively, because if not, as Reagan said, our freedom is just one generation away from being destroyed.
Well, of course, in your book, in Infamy, you touch on this, and you touch, of course, on the politicians. And I am a little bit of an expert on Afghanistan for a simple reason. I'm writing a book set in 1875 and about the British fighting in Afghanistan. So I know that nothing has changed. And if people don't understand how to fight in Afghanistan, they shouldn't be in Afghanistan. This nonsense that we send our boys in to walk in a straight line, or as you say, not to shoot at a building where somebody's shooting at you, is insane.
Absolutely. I mean, what people have to understand is these kids are our kids. They were our fathers, our uncles, our brothers, our children now.
And they're somebody's baby. They're somebody's baby.
Every one of these young men and women now who are overseas and who have been tasked with this mission, we need to understand and pray for their safety. And we may have to make sure that we use American force, that this isn't something we're doing politically. Oh, we can't do this, we can't do that, because they're placing weapons. Terrorists are placing weapons on top of roofs of hospitals, and therefore we can't do anything. But they're doing it on schools. They're doing it in populations, because politically they'll come back and say, we massacred X amount of people. If a decision is made, in my judgment, and I touch upon this in Infamy, that we send any of our young people into combat, we send them in to annihilate the enemy, and we send them in and then bring them home alive and well. That's what we need to do. Anything short of that, shame on any politician who would do otherwise.
Well, you're so right, and I just want to tell everyone that they should read your book, Infamy. It's by Robert K. Tannenbaum. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and everywhere, every bookstore. Bob, I think it's a fantastic book, and I hope that when people read it, they are motivated enough to understand, to look into what our politicians are doing, and to vote the right way, and to vote for people who are not going to politicize our justice system, to politicize our Army and our Navy and our Air Force. And, you know, that's all we can hope for, that you influence your readers.
Well, I can't thank you enough for what you just said and for giving me an opportunity to come on your show, because it's only through people like you that we can get the word out. And I'm hopeful that in some fashion that Infamy and my, this is my 31st book. I did 3 nonfiction books as well, but I'm just hopeful that whoever reads it will get a better understanding of what our values are all about and act on them, because they're precious and they were hard-earned. They were earned with the blood and lives of Americans in each generation. And that's something we have to respect and honor and motivate us to make sure that what they did was not in vain.
Well, Bob, it's been an absolute honor to talk to you, an honor to talk to somebody who is so strong in promoting justice and in promoting the American ideal of justice for all. And
I can't thank you enough, Patsy. God bless you.
Thank you, Bob, and God bless you. And I want everyone to get out there and buy this book, because it's fantastic.
So, thank you very much.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye,
Bob. Wow. What a man. He's a fantastic, as I was mentioned, a fantastic prosecutor, and himself a legend in New York City. for the work that he did, and I'm just was thrilled to be able to talk to him about his book. It's called Infamy. It's a nice short title, and it's real easy to find on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. So, you know, get it and really try to understand what he's writing about, because there's some bigger conspiracy. You know, we sometimes say, "Well, is there a conspiracy out there?" Yeah, I think there are, and I think Bob knows a lot about it. So it's something that I think that you'll all enjoy, and I was really thrilled to be able to talk to him. And I just want to remind everyone that I've got some really exciting people coming up. On Tuesday, I have our legal eagle, Bill Larson, is going to be in here. So if you have any questions, send them to me at patsy.radio@gmail.com, and I will get Bill to answer your questions. And meanwhile, just have a great weekend. I would suggest, if you have time this evening, go to the Miami Avenue Wine Bar for some great music. Meanwhile, just find your joy and share it, and have an absolutely wonderful weekend. And I'll see you here next Tuesday at 11 o'clock on Joy on Paper, right here on Tantalk Radio Network. Bye for now.